This is day two of the 2011 Christadelphian Rocky Mountains Bible School. Session speaker today is Brother Mark Vincent of the Boston Ecclesia. Brother Mark's topic for the week is the enigma of Ecclesiastes, and his class for today is entitled The Meaning of Death. Brother Mark.
Good morning, brothers and sisters. Let's just begin with a quick recap of what we did, what we discussed yesterday. So we found, didn't we, that there are some problems in interpreting the book of Ecclesiastes, in the sense that we can't simply read at the surface level and take everything that we read as being literally true in an absolute sense. We need a context for understanding Ecclesiastes, and we have a context supplied by our knowledge of the rest of Scripture and the purpose, the grand purpose of God, but we also have a context within the book of Ecclesiastes itself. Because in the book, there is no reference to God's ultimate purpose of his kingdom and the hope of resurrection. Instead, the focus is upon the things of this life and the constraints of this life. And although there is this concept of there will be judgment, most of the things that the preacher's talking about are things that happen under the sun, to believers and to unbelievers, the things of this life. We are all part of the creation that God has made. We share the human condition with unbelievers. Both believers and unbelievers alike share that condition. And its futility, its vanity, its emptiness, its absurdities, its incongruities. We all experience those things. The whole creation was made subject to vanity, as Paul explained in Romans 8. And we ourselves also, which have the first fruits of the Spirit, do groan and travail within ourselves, waiting for the adoption, the redemption of our body. And we're waiting for that, aren't we? But in the meantime, we feel the pain of being human. And the book of Ecclesiastes is an exposition of that pain. It's an exposition of what it means to be human. It's an exposition of Genesis 3 and the punishments that were put in place there. And by studying it and thinking about our condition and our situation, we can all the better prepare ourselves for how to live in the sight of God and how to prepare ourselves and to truly value that wonderful future that God has planned for us. Now, we also found that in the book of Ecclesiastes, there are two voices. There is the voice of the preacher, which runs from that frame, vanity of vanities, saith the preacher, all is vanity, to the other frame, vanity of vanities, saith the preacher, all is vanity, at 1 verse 3 and 12 verse 8. And everything inside of that marks the words of the preacher. But outside that, outside his collected observations and comments, there is another voice. There is the voice of the editor, the narrator, which gives us, there's several different metaphors we could use, I suppose. We could say it gives us a lens through which to look at the words of the preacher. So we might be able to interpret the words of the preacher in different ways. But when we look at it through the lens of the frame, then that takes us in a particular direction and leads us to look for certain messages when we read the book of Ecclesiastes. Or we could use the idea of a control. Now, I'm not a scientist at all by any stretch of the imagination. I was an arts and languages person and a bit of maths. But for those people who do experiments, there is this idea of having a control in an experiment, isn't there? And in a way, the frame, the narrator's voice, provides a control for us in how we read the words of the preacher that come in between. And we looked at the opening words, didn't we, of 1 verse 1 yesterday. And what we need to do now is look at the concluding frame, because it's that's really the key in terms of providing this lens through which to read the book, or this control. So there's the concluding frame in 12 verse 8, vanity of vanities, saith the preacher, all is vanity. And now the narrator says this to us, and moreover, because the preacher was wise, he still taught the people knowledge. So there's some interesting things going on here. So the preacher was wise. So that's telling us that, you know, what he said, the words of the preacher were not stupid. You know, we're not meant to read the words of the preacher and say, oh, well, this is like reading the words of Job's friends, just forget it all. You know, that's actually what you're not supposed to believe. And some people have actually done that with Ecclesiastes. Some people have seen the words of Ecclesiastes as being the words of a skeptic who sort of took the opposite position to Proverbs, and then and they've sort of created this idea that, you know, these words of the preacher were unearthed somewhere, and say, well, maybe we should put these into scripture, but we need to put this appendix on that contradicts it all and says that it's not true. But that just doesn't work at all. That's just completely, I just don't see how people can read it that way at all. The narrator here is telling us very clearly that the preacher was wise. And the preacher, of course, studied wisdom, didn't he? And he saw the advantages of wisdom, and he also saw the limitations of wisdom. But even looking at the limitations of wisdom, he still persisted in being wise and in valuing wisdom. So even after all the skeptical things that are said about wisdom in the book, the bottom line is that the preacher still believed in wisdom. He saw its limits, but he still believed in it. Because the preacher was wise, he still taught the people knowledge. So some people regard the preacher as being such a skeptic, you know, that you might think, well, he may as well just slit his wrists and end it now, you know, because life is just so miserable and, you know, it's all going to end in death anyway. So, you know, why don't I just sit down and quit bothering? And here, the narrator is telling us that's not the conclusion that the preacher drew, and that's not what he did. So he observed all these things about life and collected these observations. And he still taught the people knowledge. And you notice who it is that he teaches. He's not some academic, is he? You know, sitting alone with his books in some dusty room. He's teaching the people, the ordinary people, knowledge. So the point of his words is that people like us can read them and can grow to be wise ourselves and can... you can benefit spiritually from them. He still taught the people knowledge, yea, he gave good heed and sought out and set in order many proverbs. So after all his observations, he didn't give up. He didn't say, oh, well, it's just all a waste of time. It's all just so meaningless. I'm not going to bother, or I'm just going to go and, you know, sit down and mope somewhere, or I'm just going to go and party because it's all meaningless anyway, so I may as well. No, he didn't do any of those things. He still taught the people knowledge, and he gave good heed. He worked hard, and he sought out and set in order many proverbs. Now, we know someone who did that, don't we? And, of course, that's Solomon. So that was what the preacher did. The preacher sought to find out acceptable words, and that which was written was upright, even words of truth. Now, there then is quite an explicit verse telling us that, you know, the words of the preacher are words of truth and rightness. They're right in a certain context, but they're true and right words. So this idea that you can say, well, you know, the preacher is the skeptic, and then the appendix to the book says, actually, that's not true, just doesn't work, does it? Because the appendix here is telling us the words of the preacher are right and true. So when we read the words of the preacher in Ecclesiastes, we're not dealing with the words of Job's friends, or we're not dealing with the fool who said in his heart, there is no God. We're dealing with words which are right and true in a certain sense, in the sense of being an exposition of Genesis 3, in the sense of exploring what it is to be a partaker of human nature. And you notice he sought to find out acceptable words. And that meant that means that he gave attention to the presentation of what he had to say, didn't he? And this is important for brothers when we teach, isn't it? And when we present the results of our Bible study, you know, you can't really have the attitude of, well, you know, I'm just gonna do my Bible study, and you know, I'm not gonna think about how it's presented. The preacher here gave good heed. He paid attention. He sought to find out pleasing words, words that would actually, reach out to an audience, because he was a preacher, wasn't he? That would reach out to an audience and draw them in and inspire them and motivate them to go out and live differently. And that's what we should be trying to do. We should be giving attention, obviously, to the content of what we're saying, shouldn't we, brethren, when we teach and when we preach. But we also need to spend time to think about how we're presenting the teachings and to make sure that we're doing that to the best of our ability. Now, then he says something in verse 11. The words of the wise, of which the preacher was one, are as goads and as nails fastened by the masters of assembly, which are given from one shepherd. Now, that's a bit of a complicated verse, and, you know, there's some debate about how exactly to translate it. But I think the essential ideas here are actually quite clear. And there are two images that are being used, both of which are related. So the words of the wise are as goads. Now, that's a fairly straightforward bit, then. What's a goad? Well, it's like a cattle prod, isn't it? It's the thing that is used to make the ox do something. So here, the editor or the narrator is telling us that the words of the preacher, as one of the wise men of the ancient world, has brought these words together to be like a cattle prod. And we are the people that he's prodding. We're meant to read the book of Ecclesiastes and go out and do something because of it. We're meant to be different people because of having read this book. It's meant to be a goad for us, just like the book of Proverbs is a goad. Ecclesiastes is a different sort of goad, but it's still a goad that should be motivating us and prodding us into action. Not to inaction, not to skeptical inaction, but to positive action as we live our lives before God. And then the second bit then, which is the more complicated bit. And the idea here is that a master of assemblies should probably be like a master of collections. The word master there is actually the word Baal, the word Lord. The idea here is of someone who is an expert in wise words. And the words of an expert in wise words are to be like nails fastened by a shepherd. Now, you could think of that as, you know, putting nails in a fence to stop the sheep from escaping. More probably, this is a nail fastened on the end of a stick that was used again for prodding. So, like the goad, it's more or less a synonym of the goad metaphor. So you've got a shepherd here with a stick with a nail on the end of it, prodding the shepherd. Prodding the sheep to get them to go where he wants them to go. So the words of the wise are as goads, and the expert. The master of collections or the expert in wise words is like a shepherd with a stick prompting us into the way that we should go. And again, brethren, when we do our exposition and when we share it with our brothers and sisters in speaking and the various different forums that we have for doing that, we need to be conscious of what the aim is there then. It's never really study for study's sake, is it? Yes, we study because we want to know and we want to understand, but there's always this practical outworking of it, that the sheep, that the ox, that the people that we're sharing the results of our studies with that we should all together be changed and transformed and do things differently because of what we've learned. Interesting then, isn't it, that after that verse about the importance of practical Bible study and speaking that makes us do things, live differently, he should make the contrast and say, further, by these my son be admonished, of making of many books there is no end, and much study is a weariness of the flesh. So we talked about all those books that have, you know, it fits together perfectly, doesn't it? That study has a point to it. And there's no end to writing books. We talked about all those books that had been written about Ecclesiastes yesterday. There's all kinds of theory, of opinion, of debate out there, but we don't indulge in that for its own sake. You know, like there's a certain part of academic life that's just about that, isn't it? You know, like how many footnotes were in your PhD? You know, I had more footnotes than you. And you know, I've been there and I've done that. I've done my share of footnotes. Served my time. But you know, it's just a lot of it is. It's just so meaningless. A lot of it is. You know, and really, it's about the conclusion, isn't it? You know, what are we actually learning from this, and what difference is it going to make? That's the question that we should be, you know, that we should have at the back of our mind as we do our study. So really, there's a sense in which the narrator is saying, okay, so we've had our time now thinking about the words of the preacher. We've had our time considering the human condition and the various incongruities and difficulties and frustrations and vanities in life. And now it's time to get out there and get back on with it again. You know, we're not going to sit around bemoaning. We're going to go out there and live our lives to God and do the best we can to serve him. And do you see how the narrator here, this voice, is sort of drawing us all together now and saying, it's a shame that we have to live in this vain world because of human sinfulness, but that's how it is by God's design, and by God's grace we have a hope for something better. So let's now get out there, you know, and go out and live our lives to God and not to ourselves. Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. Well, this is every man. And you know, the idea of that really is that's what it's all about. That's what really matters. At the end of the day, the bottom line is we should be fearing God and keeping his commandments. Now, some people say, well, how can you get that message from Ecclesiastes? Well, from the words of the preacher, well, this is the lens through which we should be reading the words of the preacher. We should be looking to extract that message from it. And once we look at it through that lens, the book makes a whole lot of sense, I think, and it has a huge amount of beauty. You know, sometimes we use just this idea of you'll notice there that the word duty is in italics if you have a King James. So literally, this is the whole man, or this is every man, and that's an interesting idea. You know, we have the expression "I'm all ears," don't we? Now, we don't literally mean that. You know, if I say I'm all ears, I don't literally mean I've turned into some huge pair of ears. We mean that right now, in this moment, I'm totally there for you. I'm listening, and there's nothing else. There's no distraction. There's nothing else I'm thinking about. I'm just listening to you. I'm giving you my undivided attention. I'm all ears. And similarly, there's a verse in the Psalms. Do I have it written down here? Psalm 120, verse 7, I think, the AV, I think, says, I am for peace. But they are, you know, they're not. They're just interested in having a fight or, you know, causing trouble. And the word "for" there isn't literally there. Literally, he's saying, "I'm peace. That's all I'm about. Peace. That's all I want. That's all that concerns me. Peace." And these other people are just, you know, causing trouble. And this is a similar idea there. Fearing God and keeping his commandments. That's what we should. That's the totality of what we should be. That's what it's all about. That should be the sum for us. That should be the conclusion of the whole matter. That should be the headline under which everything in our life is conducted, the banner for our lives. For God shall bring every work into judgment, and every secret thing, whether it be good or whether it be evil. So there's our lens then, there's our control, as we go back now inside the words of the preacher and start to consider what it is that, in some more detail, some of the observations that he draws. Just a couple of things I want to do real quick before we get into that. So we talked about the expression vanity yesterday, didn't we? We talked about what that meant. And there was another expression which is characteristic of Ecclesiastes, which is the expression vexation of spirit. What about that? Well, there's a number of different words, different ways that we can understand that. You know the word for spirit and the word for wind, it's the same word. So we might think of this word vexation, it can mean pursuit. So, and the pursuit of wind. Well, that sounds pretty pointless, doesn't it? You know, why would you do that? It's like, here I am running around, you know, it's blowing a gale out there, and I'm running around trying to catch the wind, and I can't ever do it. You see how that fits with the idea of vanity. Another way people understand this word, or another meaning that this word vexation can have, is the meaning of shepherding the wind. And again, you can imagine a shepherd, and you know, instead of prodding the sheep around, you're trying to prod the wind and get it to go where you want it to go and keep it all contained. And of course, you can't do it. And as soon as you do contain some wind, it's not wind anymore, is it? It's just air just sat there. And it ceases to be wind. You can't ever get hold of it. And people also take this in the sense of what's the term? I'm just blanking on the term. The equivalent term that we would use would be hot air. You know, when we talk about people, you know, just speaking hot air. That vanity of vanities would mean something like that, and that, you know, so much of life lived as an end of itself here and now is just like that. It doesn't have any ultimate significance or meaning. Now, I also just want to share with you some numerical patterns. Now, I don't know what you think about numbers in Scripture. You know, some people are quite into that topic, aren't they? And some people think it's contrived. I suppose I'm somewhere in between the two. Sometimes I hear examples of supposed or alleged numerical patterns, and I do find it contrived and far-fetched. But there are other cases that I think are just amazing and wonderful. There's no proof either way, is there, in this stage of life? And so, you know, we take a look at the evidence and we take our view. Let me just share these with you, and you know, I'll just put these out there on the table, and you know, they're interesting, and you can sort of take them or leave them. The numerical value of the word vanity is 37. Guess how many times it occurs in Ecclesiastes? Don't need me to tell you. There are a couple of other occurrences actually as well, which I thought I had written down, and now I can't see them. I've got them written down somewhere. There are a couple of other occurrences as well that, you know, there's textual debate about between scholars, and it's generally accepted that they're not authentic to the text, and that's how you get to the 37. But someone could say, actually, I think there are 39 occurrences. So, you know, it's one of those things where you have to take the view, and then you say to yourself, well, is it worth my time spending hours and hours researching, you know, the textual those textually doubtful cases and coming to a definitive view on this. And that's an example for me where I think, well, there's probably more profitable study to be done than that. Let's just pursue this a little bit longer, though. So vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Of course, the word vanity there occurs three times, doesn't it, in that frame expression. And if you add that together, you get 111, three 37s. Take 111 verses into Ecclesiastes, and you get the precise midpoint of the book, which is 6 verse 9. And if you look at 6 verse 9, you'll find that it says something interesting. Better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of the desire. This also is vanity and vexation of spirit. So that's a kind of an appropriate thing, isn't it? This also is vanity and vexation of spirit. That's quite an appropriate thing as the midpoint of the book. Now, it turns out, if you count the number of words before that expression, this also is vanity and vexation of spirit, and you count the number of words after that expression to the end of the book, this also is vanity and vexation of spirit, you get exactly the same number. So this is the midpoint of the book in terms of verses. It's also the midpoint of the book in terms of words. I think that's pretty interesting. What else? Well, let's take our frame expression, vanity of vanities, all is vanity, and you add all that together, you get a numerical value of 216. If you count 216 verses from the beginning of the book, guess where you end up? You end up with vanity of vanities, saith the preacher, all is vanity. You get to the concluding frame in 12 verse 8. Which again, you know, it's interesting. So I'm not going anywhere with this. I just, you know, this is just something I've read. I didn't count these. You know, I can't vouch for these myself. It was actually done by a man called A. Wright with a W, who wrote an article called The Riddle of the Sphinx. And this was his riddle, all these numerical patterns. And he had a load of other numerical patterns as well as the ones I've shared with you that I'm not going to go into because they start to get more contrived, in my opinion. And he wrote that in a magazine called the Catholic Biblical Quarterly. And then he had a second article. That was back in the 60s. And then he had a second article in the 80s, I think, that came up with some more patterns. Let me see if there's any more to share. I think that's enough. But it gives you a flavour of some interesting things that may or may not be... be there or be deliberate. Time now then to, as we said before, step inside the words of the preacher. And what I'd like us to do is to step inside from both ends. So we're going to go just inside the frame at 1 verse 2 to the first poem or piece, and then we're going to do the same at the end of the book. We're going to step in from the end frame in 12 verse 8 and look at 12 verses 1 to 7. And we'll probably do the first part, the chapter 1 part today, and we'll do the chapter 12 part tomorrow, I think, if the time goes as my best guess. So let's then now, for probably the remainder of our time, look at the passage that begins in chapter 1 and verse 3. What profit hath a man of all his labor which he taketh under the sun? So that's the opening question then. What profit is there? Now, profit, what is profit? Well, I'm sure there are some accountants in here. We did pretty well with Brother Simon's financial stuff last night, didn't we? Obviously you have your sales, don't you? And then you have your costs. And what's left over at the end is the profit. That's what's left over, and that's what you take away with you, isn't it? Well, what is it that we take away with us from this life? Well, it's not a lot, is it? It's not a lot. And we are certain that we can carry nothing with us. That's a scriptural quote, isn't it, that Paul... We brought nothing into this world. And it's certain that we won't be taking anything away with us when we go, for all the Pharaoh's attempts to do so. So what will there be left over? What profit will there be? And that is literally what this word, what this Hebrew word means. It means that which goes beyond, that which is left over, that which extends beyond. Nothing. But it's a rhetorical question. He doesn't answer that. He just asks the question at this point, doesn't he? What profit hath a man of all his labor which he taketh under the sun? So he's going to examine then the various activities that men and women get up to in their lives, and he's going to show that for each of them, no matter where we turn, there is nothing that goes beyond. There is nothing left over. Again, looked at in the context of life here and now. So what he does is to make a contrast now, or a comparison between man's experience and the various processes and cycles of nature. One generation passeth away, and another generation cometh, but the earth abideth forever. So this is a contrast then, isn't it? There's a contrast between the earth, which is just there, and, you know, it sits there, and it has sat there, and it is just, you know, that's like sort of the best approximation we can get for eternity, isn't it? You know, until we start thinking about God, something that is permanent, something that is definite, something that is solid, that's not going anywhere, it's just there. And in contrast to the there-ness of the earth, so, you know, as far as we're concerned, it's always been there and it's always going to be there. We're just passing along, aren't we? One generation passeth, another generation goeth. You know, it's like lemmings, isn't it? Just sort of going by, and we're just watching them. You know, one of them's born and it comes up, it comes. And I remember Brother Alfred Norris. Has Brother Alfred Norris ever spoken at this Bible school? Yeah. You know, well, I remember him talking about this one of the talks that I remember. It was just a fantastic talk, and he talked about, you know, a little baby being born, and the baby sort of, you imagine this stage, and the little, you know, little baby was born, and it makes his first cry, and it sort of begins to crawl across the stage, and then it stands on its feet, and then by the time, you know, it's in its teens or its 20s, it's like, look at me, aren't I great? And then, you know, he gets into his 30s, and it realizes things aren't working quite as well as they used to, which is the stage I'm at. And then we get into our 40s, and I can only imagine what happens then. and this creature that began so small and then became so big now starts to decline, and until eventually it's staggering along, and then at last it falls off the end of the stage dead. And that was Brother Alfred's picture, and I just thought that's so in the spirit of Ecclesiastes, isn't it? Of this passage. And the earth abides, the stage is perpetual. And we just come and we go, and we think we're so big, and we think we're so important, and we're just not. You know, as far as this life is concerned. I remember someone telling me about a guy who'd worked in this company for 40 years, and it was his leaving day, and they were going to have his leaving speech. And but before he left, he had one last project that he wanted to do, you know. And so he prepared this document with sort of agenda and some kind of business plan or something. And just before his leaving speech, he went around and put this on everybody's desk so that everybody knew, even though he was going, you know, people knew where the company was going. And then his leaving speech began, and, you know, everyone clapped and said, well, how fantastic he'd be. And even as the leaving speech was going on, somebody else was going around all those desks, picking up every sheet of paper that he'd put on the desk and running it through the shredder. And, you know, that was the end of him, wasn't it? And we can seem so important, can't we, in our little worlds. And yet, we won't be remembered for very long, will we? No matter how significant or important we seem to be, you know, in our work, just as an example. And that's what the preacher is picking up here. Well, now what he does is make a comparison between the activities of men and the the processes of nature. So let's have a look at that. The sun also ariseth, and the sun goeth down, and hasteth to his place where he arose. The wind goeth toward the north, and turneth about, to the south, and turneth about unto the north. It whirleth about continually, and the wind returneth again according to his circuits. All the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full, and unto the place from whence the rivers come, there, thither, they return again. So he looks at these different cycles, doesn't he? He looks at the cycle of the sun, and he looks at the cycle of the wind, and he looks at the water cycle, and there's all this activity going on. There are all these cycles, and he's looked at the human cycle, hasn't he? Verse 4, one generation passeth away, another generation cometh. And you see, they're similar, aren't they? So we've got the sun going round and round. Oh, we're going around the sun, but you know what I mean. And then you've got the wind blowing round and round. And you've got the water going round and round. It's all very wonderful to see all these cycles going on. And you've got the generations of men going round and round. But there's a difference, isn't there? And this, again, is Brother Alfred's point. It's the same sun that goes round and round. And it's the same wind that goes round and round. And it's the same water that is recycled round and round, isn't it? But is it the same generation that goes round and round and round? No, it's not. We only make one trip across that stage, don't we? And that's the end. And in a sense, there's something pathetic about that in comparison to the cycles of nature. So why is it that then? Why is it, if we're the pinnacle of God's creation, you know, if God waited until the sixth day to make man and women as his crowning achievement in creation and to put all things under his feet, why is it that all these things are going on and on and on perpetually in nature and all we can manage is the 70 years? Well, we know why that is, don't we? That is Genesis 3. That's the power of the punishment in Genesis 3, isn't it? That the creation should mock us in that way by its permanence in comparison to our own transience, our own vanity, vapor-like existence, our own ephemeral nature. Now, and yet, within human experience, it's the same thing, isn't it? So I may only go across that stage once, and you might only go across it once, but everyone who goes across it experiences broadly the same things. And there's nothing new under the sun, is there? And that's what he goes on to say. Verse 8, all things are full of labor, man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. Has any eye that ever walked across that stage been satisfied with seeing, or the ear with hearing? Not one of them. It's been exactly the same in every case. That thing which hath been is that which shall be, and that which shall be done is that which is done is that which shall be done, and there is no new thing under the sun. Is there anything whereof it may be said, see, this is new, it hath already been of old time which was before us? So our experience, even though we're all different, all our experience is derivative, isn't it? It's the same as what happened before. You know, something you can say, well, hang on a minute, isn't Facebook new? And then you say, no, it's not new, is it? People have always been nosy. And people have and people have always been obsessed with themselves. Yeah? And people have always wanted to share things with each other and to be in touch, haven't they? To have this sense of I'm connected. And so in that sense, you know, it's just a different wrapper on the same basic thing, isn't it? The same basic patterns of human experience. But there's no wonder why you should look at all this then and say this also is vanity and vexation of spirit, is there? Let's look at. Like, I just want to go back again for a second into verses 4 to 7, and I'd like to just point out all the verbs of motion that there are in this little passage. Verse 4, one generation passeth away, and another generation cometh. So the verb, now this is a bit of a pain. I'm sorry about this, because in the Hebrew, they're very clear verbs of motion, and they're translated different ways in the King James Version. But basically, you've got a generation coming, and you've got a generation going in that verse. If we go on to verse 6, we've got the verb to go again. The wind goeth toward the south and turneth about toward the north. It whirleth about continually, literally, whirling goes the wind. There's the verb to go again. And in verse 7, all the rivers go into the sea, yet the sea is not full. And unto the place to which they go, there they return to go. The verb go again three times in that verse. And then the verb come. So that's the verb go. I don't know what that is. If you add all those together, it's probably seven or so occurrences of go. Then you've got the verb come. One generation goes, another generation comes. The sun rises and comes, literally, in verse 5. And then you've got the whirling, haven't you, in verse six. And that occurs four times, this whirling. The wind goeth toward the south and whirls about to the north. It whirls about, whirling. And the wind returns again according to its whirlings, literally. So four whirlings in that verse. And then you've got the verb return that occurs in verse six. The wind returns again according to its whirlings. And you've got it in verse 7. From whence the rivers come, thither they return again. So you've got all those goings, you've got all those comings, you've got all those whirlings, all those returning. This is just laid on so thick. You know, all these verbs of motion. It's exhausting just thinking about it, isn't it? So much movement that it's almost like dizzying. All this stuff going on in the world. But is there any profit from it? Is it going anywhere? No, it's just going round and round and round and round, and we're just getting dizzy. And no wonder then that he says in verse 8, all things are full of labor, man cannot utter it. Yeah? He's just exhausted just thinking about it. And it's so meaningless. If this is all there is, it is so meaningless. And the reader of Ecclesiastes is of all men most miserable for seeing that it is that way. You know, we cover it up, don't we? We pretend that it isn't like that because we get so busy and we're focused on what it is that we're doing, and we're busy with that, and we don't think about the emptiness of it all. But when we do stop to think about it, if we had no hope for the future, if we had no God, no relationship with Him, that's all there would be, wouldn't it? All this endless whirling. And you see the wind whirling and the sun going round and the water going round. And then I look at my own life and I see me going round and round and round like a spinning top. And we're all doing that. Every one of us is doing that in our lives, isn't it? And the challenge is, can we stop? Can we stop whirling and going and coming and returning to take time for God, to think about Him, and to think about the things that really count in life, the things that transcend this vanity and that have ultimate and lasting value. You know, when Paul talks to the Corinthians about that weight of glory, doesn't he? About how God's ways and the renewal that He can works within us, a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. He's using the very opposite term of the term vanity, isn't he? I think it's a deliberate contrast there. If this life is vanity, God can produce in our lives something that has weight, something that has substance, something which will not just be blown away, something that goes beyond this little stage that we must each walk across. The final point I want to make is that each of these verbs, go, come, return, and even the whirling, they're all used again in Ecclesiastes, and they're used in that final poem before the frame in chapter 12. Now, we're not going to look at that poem until tomorrow. But isn't that powerful? That all those key words of movement from chapter 1, they're all there again in chapter 12 in that poem about the demise of human beings as they go where? As they go somewhere important. Where is it they're going? They're going to the grave. All right. So do you notice in chapter 1, everything has its place. The sun goes and returns to its place. And there it goes again from there. And you see where this is going. And this is so powerful, isn't it? I just think this is amazing. And the wind has its circuits. And that's the place for the wind. And it goes round on those circuits. It doesn't come off the rails. It goes on its circuits. And the water has this cycle. It has its place and it returns to the sea. And then it goes round again. One generation cometh and goes. And what chapter 1 doesn't say is where the place of man is. And that's held out in suspense. And we don't find what our place is until we get to chapter 12. And it says, because a man is going to his eternal home, his eternal place. Where's that place? That place is the grave. That is the most tragic ending, isn't it? If we don't have God, that's all we have. That's the only place, that's the only home that we have to look forward to. But thanks be to God, and praise be to Him, that we now have another home. Our home now is about heavenly places in Christ, isn't it?